Chapter 40. Struggling with the gear shift, Langdon managed to maneuver the hijacked taxi to the far side of the Bois de Boulogne, while only stalling twice. Unfortunately, the inherent humor in the situation was overshadowed by the taxi dispatcher repeatedly hailing their cab over the radio.
Voiture 563, où êtes-vous? Répondez!
When Langdon reached the exit of the park, he swallowed his machismo and jammed on the brakes.
You'd better drive.
Sophie looked relieved as she jumped behind the wheel. Within seconds, she had the car humming smoothly westward along Allée de Longchamp, leaving the Garden of Earthly Delights behind.
Which way is Rue Haxo?
Langdon asked, watching Sophie edge the speedometer over 100 kilometers an hour. Sophie's eyes remained focused on the road.
The cab driver said it's adjacent to the Roland Garros tennis stadium. I know that area.
Langdon pulled the heavy key from his pocket again, feeling the weight in his palm. He sensed it was an object of enormous consequence, quite possibly the key to his own freedom. Earlier, while telling Sophie about the Knights Templar, Langdon had realized that this key, in addition to having the Priory seal embossed on it, possessed a more subtle tie to the Priory of Sion. The equal-armed cruciform was symbolic of balance and harmony, but also of the Knights Templar. Everyone had seen the paintings of Knights Templar wearing white tunics emblazoned with bright red equal-armed crosses. Granted, the arms of the Templar cross were slightly flared at the ends, but they were still of equal length.
A square cross, just like the one on this key.
Langdon felt his imagination starting to run wild as he fantasized about what they might find.
The Holy Grail.
He almost laughed out loud at the absurdity of it. The Grail was believed to be somewhere in England, buried in a hidden chamber beneath one of the many Templar churches, where it had been hidden since at least 1500.
The era of Grand Master da Vinci.
The Priory, in order to keep their powerful documents safe, had been forced to move them many times in the early centuries. Historians now suspected as many as 6 different Grail relocations since its arrival in Europe from Jerusalem. The last Grail sighting had been in 1447, when numerous eyewitnesses described a fire that had broken out and almost engulfed the documents before they were carried to safety in 4 huge chests that each required 6 men to carry. After that, nobody claimed to see the Grail ever again. All that remained were occasional whisperings that it was hidden in Great Britain, the land of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Wherever it was, 2 important facts remained. Leonardo knew where the Grail resided during his lifetime. That hiding place had probably not changed to this day. For this reason, Grail enthusiasts still pored over da Vinci's art and diaries in hopes of unearthing a hidden clue as to the Grail's current location. Some claimed the mountainous backdrop in Madonna of the Rocks matched the topography of a series of cave-ridden hills in Scotland. Others insisted that the suspicious placement of disciples in the Last Supper was some kind of code. Still others claimed that X-rays of the Mona Lisa revealed she originally had been painted wearing a lapis lazuli pendant of Isis, a detail da Vinci purportedly later decided to paint over. Langdon had never seen any evidence of the pendant, nor could he imagine how it could possibly reveal the Holy Grail, and yet Grail aficionados still discussed it ad nauseam on internet bulletin boards and chat rooms.
Everyone loves a conspiracy.
And the conspiracies kept coming. Most recently, of course, had been the earth-shaking discovery that da Vinci's famed Adoration of the Magi was hiding a dark secret beneath its layers of paint. Italian art diagnostician Maurizio Seracini had unveiled the unsettling truth in April of 2002, and news resonated loudly enough to appear that very week in a New York Times magazine story titled "The Leonardo Cover-Up." Seracini had revealed beyond any doubt that while the Adoration's gray-green sketched underdrawing was indeed da Vinci's work, the painting itself was not. The truth was that some anonymous painter had filled in da Vinci's sketch like a paint-by-numbers years after da Vinci's death. Far more troubling, however, was what lay beneath the imposter's paint. Allegedly, photographs taken with infrared reflectography and X-ray suggested that this rogue painter, while filling in da Vinci's sketched study, had made suspicious departures from the underdrawing, as if to subvert da Vinci's true intention. Whatever the true nature of the underdrawing, it had yet to be made public. Even so, embarrassed officials at Florence's Uffizi Gallery immediately banished the painting to a warehouse across the street. Visitors at the gallery's Leonardo room now found a misleading and unapologetic plaque where the Adoration once hung. This work is undergoing diagnostic tests in preparation for restoration. In the bizarre underworld of modern grail seekers, Leonardo da Vinci remained the quest's great enigma. His artwork seemed bursting to tell a secret, and yet, whatever it was remained hidden, perhaps beneath a layer of paint, perhaps enciphered in plain view, or perhaps nowhere at all. Da Vinci's plethora of tantalizing clues was nothing but an empty promise left behind to frustrate the curious and bring a smirk to the face of his knowing Mona Lisa.
"Is it possible," Sophie asked, drawing Langdon back, "that the key you're holding unlocks the hiding place of the Holy Grail?"
Langdon's laugh sounded forced, even to him. "I can't really imagine. Besides, the Grail is believed to be hidden in the United Kingdom somewhere, not France." He gave her the quick history.
"But the Grail seems the only rational conclusion," she insisted. "We have an extremely secure key, stamped with the Priory of Sion seal, delivered to us by a member of the Priory of Sion, a brotherhood which, you just told me, are guardians of the Holy Grail."
Langdon knew her contention was logical, and yet intuitively, he could not possibly accept it. Rumors existed that the Priory had vowed someday to bring the Grail back to France to a final resting place, but certainly no historical evidence existed to suggest that this indeed had happened. Even if the Priory had indeed managed to bring the Grail back to France, the address 24 Rue Haxo, near a tennis stadium, hardly sounded like a noble final resting place. "Sophie, I really don't see how this key could have anything to do with the Grail."
"Because the Grail is supposed to be in England?"
"Not only that, the location of the Holy Grail is one of the best-kept secrets in history. Priory members wait decades proving themselves trustworthy before being elevated to the highest echelons of the fraternity and learning where the Grail is. That secret is protected by an intricate system of compartmentalized knowledge, and although the Priory Brotherhood is very large, only 4 members at any given time know where the Grail is hidden: the Grand Master and his 3 seneschaux. The probability of your grandfather being one of those 4 top people is very slim."
"My grandfather was one of them," Sophie thought,
pressing down on the accelerator. She had an image seared in her memory that confirmed her grandfather's status within the Brotherhood beyond any doubt. "And even if your grandfather were in the upper echelon, he would never be allowed to reveal anything to anyone outside the Brotherhood. It is inconceivable that he would bring you into the inner circle."
"I've already been there," Sophie thought,
picturing the ritual in the basement. She wondered if this were the moment to tell Langdon what she had witnessed that night in the mountain chateau. For 10 years now, simple shame had kept her from telling a soul. Just thinking about it, she shuddered. Sirens howled somewhere in the distance, and she felt a thickening shroud of fatigue settling over her.
"There,"
Langdon said, feeling excited to see the huge complex of Roland Garros tennis stadium looming ahead. Sophie snaked her way toward the stadium. After several passes, they located the intersection of Rue Haxo and turned onto it, driving in the direction of the lower numbers. The road became more industrial, lined with businesses.
"We need number 24,
Langdon told himself, realizing he was secretly scanning the horizon for the spires of a church.
"Don't be ridiculous. A forgotten Templar church in this neighborhood?"
"There it is,"
Sophie exclaimed, pointing. Langdon's eyes followed her arm to the structure ahead.
"What in the world?"
The building was modern, a squat citadel with a giant neon equal-armed cross emblazoned atop its facade. Beneath the cross were the words, "Depository Bank of Zurich." Langdon was thankful not to have shared his Templar Church hopes with Sophie. A career hazard of symbologists was a tendency to extract hidden meaning from places that had none. In this case, Langdon had entirely forgotten that the peaceful, equal-armed cross had been adopted as the perfect symbol for the flag of neutral Switzerland. At least the mystery was solved. Sophie and Langdon were holding the key to a Swiss bank deposit box. Chapter 41. Outside Castel Gandolfo, an updraft of mountain air gushed over the top of the cliff and across the high bluff, sending a chill through Bishop Aringarosa as he stepped from the Fiat.
I should have worn more than this cassock, he thought, fighting the reflex to shiver.
The last thing he needed to appear tonight was weak or fearful. The castle was dark save the windows at the very top of the building, which glowed ominously.
The library, Aringarosa thought. They are awake and waiting.
He ducked his head against the wind and continued on without so much as a glance toward the observatory domes, which he was certain still resembled two infected goiters on the roof. The priest who greeted him at the door looked sleepy. He was the same priest who had greeted Aringarosa 5 months ago, albeit tonight he did so with much less hospitality.
"We were worried about you, Bishop,"
the priest said, checking his watch and looking more perturbed than worried.
"My apologies. Airlines are so unreliable these days."
The priest mumbled something inaudible and then said,
"They are waiting upstairs. I will escort you up."
The library was a gaping square room with dark wood from floor to ceiling. On all sides, towering bookcases burgeoned with volumes. The floor was amber marble with black basalt trim, a handsome reminder that this building had once been a palace.
"Welcome, Bishop," a man's voice said from across the room.
Aringarosa tried to see who had spoken, but the lights were ridiculously low, much lower than they had been on his first visit, when everything was ablaze.
The night of stark awakening.
Tonight these men sat in the shadows, as if they were somehow ashamed of what was about to transpire. Aringarosa entered slowly, regally even. He could see the shapes of three men at a long table on the far side of the room. The silhouette of the man in the middle was immediately recognizable. The obese Secretariat Vaticana, overlord of all legal matters within Vatican City. The other two were high-ranking Italian cardinals. Aringarosa crossed the library toward them.
"My humble apologies for the hour. We're on different time zones. You must be tired."
"Not at all," the Secretariat said, his hands folded on his enormous belly.
"We are grateful you have come so far. The least we can do is be awake to meet you. Can we offer you some coffee or refreshments?"
"I'd prefer we don't pretend this is a social visit. I have another plane to catch. Shall we get to business?"
"Of course," the Secretariat said. "You have acted more quickly than we imagined."
"Have I?"
"You still have a month."
"You made your concerns known 5 months ago," Aringarosa said. "Why should I wait?"
"Indeed, we are very pleased with your expediency."
Aringarosa's eyes traveled the length of the long table to a large black briefcase.
"Is that what I requested?"
"It is,"
the Secretariat sounded uneasy.
"Although I must admit we are concerned with the request, it seems quite..."
"Dangerous," one of the cardinals finished. "Are you certain we cannot wire it to you somewhere? The sum is exorbitant."
"Freedom is expensive."
"I have no concerns for my own safety. God is with me."
The men actually looked doubtful.
"The funds are exactly as I requested?"
The Secretariat nodded.
"Large denomination bearer bonds drawn on the Vatican Bank, negotiable as cash anywhere in the world."
Aringarosa walked to the end of the table and opened the briefcase. Inside were two thick stacks of bonds, each embossed with the Vatican seal, and the title Portatore, making the bonds redeemable to whomever was holding them. The Secretariat looked tense.
"I must admit, Bishop, all of us would feel less apprehensive if these funds were in cash."
"I could not lift that much cash," Aringarosa thought, closing the case.
"Bonds are negotiable as cash. You said so yourself."
The cardinals exchanged uneasy looks, and finally one said,
"Yes, but these bonds are traceable directly to the Vatican Bank."
Aringarosa smiled inwardly. That was precisely the reason the teacher suggested Aringarosa get the money in Vatican Bank bonds. It served as insurance.
"We are all in this together now."
"This is a perfectly legal transaction," Aringarosa defended. "Opus Dei is a personal prelature of Vatican City, and His Holiness can disperse monies however he sees fit. No law has been broken here."
True, and yet... The Secretariat leaned forward, and his chair creaked under the burden. We have no knowledge of what you intend to do with these funds, and if it is in any way illegal,
considering what you are asking of me, Aringarosa countered, what I do with this money is not your concern.
There was a long silence.
They know I'm right, Aringarosa thought. Now, I imagine you have something for me to sign?
They all jumped, eagerly pushing the paper toward him, as if they wished he would simply leave.
Aringarosa eyed the sheet before him. It bore the papal seal. This is identical to the copy you sent me?
Exactly. Aringarosa was surprised how little emotion he felt as he signed the document. The three men present, however, seemed to sigh in relief.
Thank you, Bishop, the Secretariat said. Your service to the Church will never be forgotten.
Aringarosa picked up the briefcase, sensing promise and authority in its weight. The four men looked at one another for a moment, as if there was something to say. But apparently, there was not. Aringarosa turned and headed for the door.
Bishop,
one of the cardinals called out as Aringarosa reached the threshold. Aringarosa paused, turning.
Yes?
Where will you go from here?
Aringarosa sensed the query was more spiritual than geographical, and yet he had no intention of discussing morality at this hour.
Paris, he said, and walked out the door.